Opposite the harbor mouth, on a rise of ground, stands a temple of Caesar, remarkable for its beauty and size. In it is a colossal statue of Caesar, not inferior to the Olympian Zeus, on which it was modeled, and one of Rome equal to the Hera of Argos. He dedicated the city to the province, the harbor to those who sail these waters, and the honor of the whole construction to Caesar. Accordingly, he named it Caesarea. The rest of the works, an amphitheater, a theater, and marketplaces, he built worthy of that name as well. He also instituted games held every 4 years, likewise named after Caesar, and was himself the first to offer the greatest prizes in the 192nd Olympiad, in which not only the winners but also those who came second and third shared in the king's wealth. He rebuilt the coastal town of Anthedon, destroyed in war, and renamed it Agrippaean, out of excessive devotion to his friend, whose name he also inscribed on the gate he himself built in the temple. He was, if any man was, devoted to his father. He raised a monument to him in the form of a city, which he founded in the finest plain of his kingdom, rich in rivers and trees, and named Antipatris. He also fortified the stronghold above Jericho, remarkable for its strength and beauty, and dedicated it to his mother, calling it Cypros. For his brother Phasael, he built the tower in Jerusalem bearing his name, whose form and lavish scale we will describe in what follows. And he founded another city in the valley leading north from Jericho, which he named Phasaelis. Having provided for his household and friends in this way, he did not neglect his own memory either. He fortified a stronghold on the mountain toward Arabia and named it Herodaean after himself, and the breast-shaped hill, artificially made, 60 stadia from Jerusalem, he likewise named after himself, but adorned it more lavishly still. He surrounded its summit with round towers and filled the enclosure with the most costly palaces, so that not only the interior of the rooms was splendid to see, but wealth was lavished on the outer walls, copings, and roofs as well. From far off, at enormous expense, he brought in an abundance of water and laid an ascent of 200 steps of purest marble, for the hill was fairly high and entirely artificial. Around its base, he also built other palaces able to house his baggage and his friends, so that because it had everything, the fortress seemed like a city, though in its layout a palace. Having built so much, he displayed his generosity toward a great many cities outside his kingdom as well. To Tripolis, Damascus, and Ptolemais he gave gymnasia, to Byblos, a wall, to Berytus and Tyre, exedras, colonnades, temples, and marketplaces, to Sidon and Damascus, theaters, to the coastal Laodiceans and aqueduct, to the people of Ascalon, baths and costly fountains, and colonnades admired for their workmanship and size. To some he dedicated groves and meadows. Many cities, as though they were partners in his kingdom, received territory from him as well. On others he bestowed annual and perpetual revenues to fund gymnasiarchies, as he did for the cones, so that this honor would never lapse. He supplied grain to all who were in need, and gave money to roads, many times and in many ways, for building their fleet, and when the temple of Apollo there burned down, he rebuilt it at his own expense, and better than before. What need is there to speak of his gifts to the Lycians or the Samians, or of his generosity throughout all Ionia, wherever people were in need? The Athenians, the Spartans, the people of Nicopolis and Pergamum and Mysia, are they not full of Herod's dedications? And the broad street of the Syrian Antiochines, which people avoided because of the mud, did he not pave it with polished marble for 20 stadia in length, and adorn it with a colonnade of equal length as protection from the rain? These gifts one might call particular to each people that benefited from them. But what he granted the Eleans was a gift not only to Greece as a whole, but to the entire inhabited world, since the fame of the Olympic Games reaches to it. Seeing that these games were collapsing for lack of funds, and the sole remnant of ancient Greece slipping away, he not only became the president of the games for the 1 4-year cycle he happened to attend, sailing to Rome, but also provided funds in perpetuity, so that the memory of his presidency would never fade. It would be an endless task to go through his cancellations of debts or remissions of taxes, as when he lightened the annual tribute for the people of Phasaelis, Balania, and the small towns of Cilicia. Yet his greatest generosity was checked most of all by fear of seeming to court popularity, or to be pursuing something greater by benefiting cities more than their own means allowed. His body matched his spirit. He was always an excellent hunter, succeeding in this especially through his skill on horseback. On one occasion, he brought down 40 wild animals in a single day. The country breeds wild boar and is abundantly stocked with deer and wild asses. As a warrior, he was irresistible. Many, watching him at exercises, were amazed to see him the most accurate of javelin throwers and the surest of archers. To his advantages of mind and body, good fortune was added as well. He rarely suffered a setback in war, and when he did, the fault lay not with him, but with the treachery of some or the recklessness of his soldiers. Yet fortune avenged his successes abroad with troubles at home, and his misfortunes began with the woman he loved most. For when he came to power, he divorced the wife he had married as a private citizen. Her name was Doris, from Jerusalem, and married Mariam, daughter of Alexander, son of Aristobulus. Because of her, his household fell into faction sooner than one might expect, but especially after his return from Rome. First, he banished Antipater, his son by Doris, from the city on account of the children he had by Mariam, allowing him to return only for festivals. Then he killed Hyrcanus, his wife's grandfather, who had come to him from the Parthians, out of suspicion of a plot, the same Hyrcanus whom Barzapharnes had taken captive when he overran Syria, and whom their fellow countrymen beyond the Euphrates had begged for out of pity. Had he listened to their advice not to cross over to Herod, he would not have perished. But the marriage of his granddaughter proved the bait that lured him to his death. Trusting in this and yearning more than was wise for his homeland, he came. It was not that he himself aspired to the kingship that provoked Herod, but that kingship fell naturally to him. Of the five children born to him by Mariam, two were daughters and three were sons. Of these, the youngest died being educated in Rome, and Herod raised the two eldest as royal heirs, both because of their mother's noble birth and because they had been born to him as king. Stronger than all these considerations was Herod's love for Mariam, which burned in him more fiercely day by day, so that he was insensible to all the pain her attitude caused him, for as great as his love for her was, so great was her hatred of him. Her resentment had a reasonable basis in what had happened, and speaking her mind came from being loved. She openly reproached him for what he had done to her grandfather Hyrcanus and to her brother Jonathan. For he had not spared Jonathan either. Boy though he was, he gave him the high priesthood at 17, and immediately after honoring him put him to death, because when the boy put on the sacred vestments and approached the altar at the festival, the crowd burst into tears at the sight of him. So the boy was sent by night to Jericho, and there, on Herod's orders, was drowned in a pool by the Galatians. For these reasons, Mariam reproached Herod, and heaped bitter insults on his sister and his mother as well. He himself was silenced by his passion for her, but the women were seized with fierce resentment, and to strike at what would most move Herod, they accused her of adultery, fabricating many plausible details. Among them, the charge that she had sent her portrait to Antony in Egypt, and out of excessive shamelessness had displayed herself, though absent, to a man mad for women and capable of taking her by force. This news struck Herod like a thunderbolt, unsettling him above all through jealous love, but also because he reckoned with Cleopatra's ruthlessness, through which King Lysanias had been put to death, and Malchus the Arab as well, for he measured the danger not by the loss of a wife, but by death itself. So when he was about to travel abroad, he entrusted his wife to Joseph, the husband of his sister Salome, a man he trusted and who was well disposed to him through their kinship, secretly giving orders to kill her if Antony killed him. But Joseph, not out of malice, but wishing to demonstrate the king's love to her, that even in death he could not bear to be parted from her, revealed the secret. When Herod returned, she, in the course of their private conversations, as he swore repeatedly how deeply he felt for her, and that he had never loved another woman, said, "You certainly showed your love for me well enough in the orders you gave Joseph, commanding him to kill me." As soon as he heard the secret revealed, he was beside himself, and declared that Joseph would never have disclosed the order unless he had seduced her. Carried away by his passion, he leapt from his bed and paced wildly about the palace. His sister Salome seized this moment to press her slanders further, confirming the suspicion against Joseph. Driven mad by unbridled jealousy, Herod at once ordered them both put to death. But remorse followed immediately upon the deed, and as his anger subsided, his love flared up again. So fierce was the fever of his desire that he seemed not even to believe she was dead, but in his grief spoke to her as though she still lived, until time taught him to grieve for her properly, with sorrow suited to one who was truly gone. Her sons inherited their mother's resentment, and coming to understand the horror of it, looked on their father as an enemy, at first while being educated in Rome, and even more once they returned to Judea. And as they grew, their feelings grew with them. When they came of age for marriage, one married the daughter of his aunt Salome, who had accused their mother, and the other married the daughter of Archelaus, king of Cappadocia, and gaining this support, they now spoke their hatred more openly. Their boldness gave their accusers an opening, and some now spoke more openly to the king, saying that both sons were plotting against him, and that the one connected by marriage to Archelaus was preparing to flee, relying on his father-in-law, in order to bring an accusation against Herod before Caesar. Filled with these slanders, Herod, as though setting up a bulwark against his sons, brought back Antipater, his son by Doris, and began to give him preference in every way. To the brothers, this reversal was unbearable, and seeing a son of a common mother advancing at the expense of their own noble birth, they could not contain their indignation, and at every grievance let their anger show, so that day by day they grew more hostile, while Antipater was now courted for his own sake as well. A man most skilled in flattering his father, and in fabricating varied slanders against his brothers, some he invented himself, others he had his associates spread. Until at last he had utterly stripped his brothers of any hope for the throne. Indeed, in the will he himself was already named successor, and openly so, he was sent to Caesar as if he were already king, using every mark of royal state except the diadem. In time he even succeeded in bringing his mother into Mariam's bed. Using two weapons against his brothers, flattery and slander, he worked on the king to the point of endangering his sons' lives. He dragged Alexander all the way to Rome, and his father brought a charge before Caesar of a plot against his own life. Alexander, having with difficulty won leave to voice his grief, and finding a judge far more experienced and wiser than Antipater or Herod, modestly passed over his father's faults, but vigorously refuted the slanders against himself. Having also shown that his brother was innocent and shared in the same dangers, he then lamented Antipater's villainy and their own dishonor. His case was helped, along with his clear conscience, by his gift for speech, for he was indeed a most powerful speaker. And in the end, saying that it would even be pleasant for their father to kill them, and offering himself to the charge, he moved everyone to tears, and so affected Caesar that he dismissed the accusations against them and reconciled Herod with them at once. The terms of reconciliation were that the sons should obey their father in everything, while he should leave the kingdom to whomever he wished. After this, the king returned from Rome, appearing to have dropped the charges against his sons, but not free of suspicion, for Antipater remained close at hand, the source of his hatred. Still, out of respect for the one who had brought about the reconciliation, he did not openly show his hostility. But as he sailed along the coast of Cilicia and put in at Eleusa, Archelaus received him warmly and gratefully for the safety of his son-in-law and joined in the reconciliation. Rejoicing at it, since he had also written more quickly to his friends in Rome, urging them to assist in Alexander's case. He escorted him as far as Zephyrium, giving him gifts worth up to 30 talents. When Herod arrived in Jerusalem, he gathered the people together, brought his three sons forward, and spoke in defense of his journey abroad. He thanked God at length, and thanked Caesar at length as well, for having set his troubled household in order, and for having granted his sons something greater than kingship. Harmony, which he himself, he said, would bring into still closer accord. For Caesar has made me master of the succession and arbiter of who inherits it, and I, in keeping with what is advantageous, repay him in kind. These three sons I declare kings, calling first upon God to ratify my judgment, and then upon you as well. Age recommends the succession to one, noble birth to the others, but the size of this kingdom is enough for even more than these. Those whom Caesar has joined together, and their father now appoints, you must maintain, giving them honors neither unjust nor uneven, but each according to his rank. For no one is so gladdened by being honored beyond his years as he is pained by being dishonored. As for the kinsmen and friends who must attend upon each of them, I will assign these myself and make them guarantors of harmony, knowing well that it is the ill nature of one's companions that breeds factions and rivalries, whereas if these men are decent, they preserve affection. And I ask not only these men, but also the officers of my army to place their hopes in me alone for the present. For I am handing over to my sons not kingship, but the honor of kingship. They will enjoy its pleasures as rulers, while the weight of affairs remains mine, even against my will. Let each of you weigh my age, my manner of life, and my piety. I am not so old a man that I might quickly be given up for dead, nor have I given myself over to the kind of luxury that cuts short even the young, and I have cultivated the divine so well that I may hope to reach the furthest span of life. Whoever pays court to my sons in hope of my downfall will answer to me concerning them as well. For it is not out of envy toward my own offspring that I check the eager attentions shown them, but because I know that such eagerness becomes, for young men, fuel for rashness. If each man who approaches them would consider that, being upright, he will receive his reward from me, but that if he stirs up faction, his ill nature will prove unprofitable even with the one he courts, I think all will come to share my mind, which is to say, my son's mind as well. For it serves them that I should rule, and it serves me that they should be in harmony. But you, good sons, consider first the sacred bond of nature, which even wild beasts preserve in their affections. Then consider Caesar, who brought about our reconciliation, and third, myself, who ask this of you while I still have the power to command it. Remain brothers. I give you now royal dress and royal attendance, and I pray to God to uphold my judgment if you keep this harmony. Having said this, and having affectionately embraced each of his sons, he dismissed the crowd, some joining in prayer for what had been said, but those who longed for a change of regime pretending not to have heard it at all. Yet the discord left with the brothers still intact, and they parted holding worse suspicions of one another than before. Alexander and Aristobulus grieving that the right of seniority had been confirmed to Antipater, Antipater resentful that his brothers ranked second to him. But Antipater, the most versatile in character of the three, knew how to hold his tongue and with great cunning concealed his hatred toward them, whereas the other two, because of their noble breeding, spoke whatever they thought. Many provoked and pressed them on, and still more of their friends slipped in among them as spies. Whatever was said by Alexander reached Antipater at once, and passed from Antipater to Herod with additions, for the young man could not simply speak without being held to account. Whatever he said was twisted into slander, and if he ever spoke with modest frankness, the smallest things were built up into the greatest. Antipater was forever sending men to provoke him, so that his lies might rest on some real foundation, and when even one of the rumors was proven true, it lent credit to all the rest. As for his own friends, each was either by nature perfectly close-mouthed or was won over with gifts so that nothing secret ever leaked out, and one would not be wrong to call Antipater's life a mystery of wickedness. But Alexander's companions he corrupted with money or won over with flattery, until he had turned every one of them into a traitor and a spy on what was done or said. Staging everything with great care, he made his approaches to Herod through slander the most skillful of all, wearing the mask of a brother himself, while sending other men as informers. Whenever some charge against Alexander was reported, he would come forward and pretend to make light of it, but then would quietly work it up and provoke the king to indignation. Everything was traced back to a plot, to the appearance that Alexander lay in wait for his father's murder, for nothing lent more credit to the slanders than Antipater's own show of defending him. Herod, exasperated by all this, transferred to Antipater, day by day, exactly as much affection as he withdrew from the young men. Some of those at court inclined the same way, some willingly, others under compulsion. Men like Ptolemy, the most honored of the king's friends, the king's own brothers, and the whole family. For Antipater was everything, and, most bitter of all to Alexander, Antipater's mother was everything too, a counselor against them harsher than any stepmother, hating the sons of the queen more fiercely than stepmothers commonly hate stepchildren. So by now everyone courted Antipater in hope of the future, and the king's own orders estranged each of them further still, since he had instructed the most honored men neither to approach nor to pay attention to Alexander's circle. He was feared not only by those within the kingdom, but by friends abroad as well. For Caesar had given no king such power that a man who fled from him could be extradited even from a city with no connection to him. The young men, meanwhile, knew nothing of the slanders, and for that very reason fell into them all the more unguardedly, for their father found no open fault with them, but came to understand things little by little from his own coolness, and grew harsher the more it pained him. Antipater also turned their uncle Pheroras against them with hostility, and their aunt Salome as well, working on her constantly, courting her favor and provoking her further. What also fed the hatred toward Salome was Alexander's wife Glaphyra, who traced out her own noble descent and boasted that she was mistress of everyone in the palace, being descended on her father's side from Temenus and on her mother's side from Darius son of Hystaspes. She often reproached Herod's sister and his wives for their low birth, since each of them had been chosen for her beauty and not for her lineage. And there were many such wives, since it was ancestral custom among the Jews to marry several, and the king delighted in having many. And all of them, because of Glaphyra's arrogance and her insults, hated Alexander. As for Salome, although she was his mother-in-law, it was Aristobulus himself who set her against him, she being already angered by Glaphyra's insults. For he constantly reproached his own wife for her low birth, saying that he had married a commoner while his brother Alexander had married a king's daughter. His wife, in tears, reported this to Salome, adding that Alexander's circle threatened that once they took the kingdom, they would make the other brothers' mothers weavers alongside the slave women, and the brothers themselves village clerks, mocking them as men so carefully educated. At this Salome, unable to contain her anger, reported everything to Herod, and she was a very credible witness in speaking against her son-in-law. Another slander converged with this one and further inflamed the king's anger. He heard that they were constantly invoking their mother's name, wailing and cursing him, and that often, when he passed on some of Mariamne's garments to his later wives, they threatened that before long they would fit them out with garments made of hair in place of royal robes. Because of this, although he had come to fear the young men's proud spirit, he did not yet abandon hope of setting things right. Instead, he summoned them, for he was also about to sail to Rome, and threatened them briefly as a king, but for the most part admonished them as a father, urging them to love their brothers and granting them pardon for their past offenses, if they would be better men in the time to come. They cleared themselves of the slanders, calling them false, and said they would confirm their defense by their deeds. But they also said that he too must block the path of such gossip by not believing it so readily, for there would never be a shortage of people willing to lie about them as long as there was someone ready to believe. Having won him over as a father with these words, they quickly dispelled the immediate danger, but took on grief for what lay ahead. For they learned that Salome was their enemy, and their uncle Pheroras too, both of them burdensome and harsh, but Pheroras the more so, since he shared in the whole kingdom except the diadem, had revenues of his own amounting to 100 talents, and enjoyed the fruit of the entire country beyond the Jordan, which he had received as a gift from his brother, who had also had him made tetrarch by petitioning Caesar on his behalf. Herod had even judged him worthy of a royal marriage, giving him his own wife's sister to marry, and after her death he had pledged to him his eldest daughter with a dowry of 300 talents. But Pheroras fled from the royal marriage out of love for a slave woman, at which Herod, in anger, joined his daughter instead to his nephew, who was later put to death by the Parthians. Yet not long after, he relaxed his anger toward Pheroras, excusing him on account of his passion. Pheroras had also been accused, even earlier while the queen was still alive, of plotting against Herod with poison, and now a great number of informers came forward, so that although Herod loved his brother more than anyone, he was led into believing what was said and into dread of it. Having tortured many of those under suspicion, he came at last to Pheroras's friends. Not one of them openly confessed to a plot, but they said that Pheroras was preparing to carry off his beloved and flee to the Parthians, and that his partners in this scheme and in the flight included Costobarus, Salome's husband, to whom the king had given her in marriage after her first husband had been put to death for adultery. nor was Salome herself free of slander, for Pheroras's own brother accused her of an agreement of marriage with Silius, the steward of Abodas, king of the Arabs, who was Herod's bitterest enemy. Cross-examined on this charge, and on every other that Pheroras brought against her, she was cleared, and the king released Pheroras himself as well from the accusations. But the storm within the household now shifted to Alexander, and settled its whole weight upon his head. There were three eunuchs held in the highest honor by the king, and their duties made this plain. One was appointed to pour his wine, another to serve his dinner, and the third put him to bed and lay down beside him. Alexander won these men over into intimacy with great gifts. When this was reported to the king, they were examined under torture. They confessed at once to the intimacy and also revealed the promises made to secure it. How they had been persuaded by Alexander, who told them they should not place their hopes in Herod, a shameless old man who dyed his hair, unless they supposed that by this he also wished to pass for young, but should look instead to him, who would succeed to the kingdom before long even against his father's will, take vengeance on his enemies, and make his friends happy and blessed, these men above all. He told them, too, that a secret following of powerful men already surrounded him, including the officers of the army and the company commanders, who met with him in private. This so terrified Herod that he did not dare bring the informations out into the open even at once, but sent spies about by night and by day to search out everything done or said, and put to death at once anyone who fell under suspicion. The palace was filled with dreadful lawlessness. Everyone, out of private enmity or hatred, fabricated slanders of his own, and many used the king's murderous temper as a weapon against their rivals. A lie won instant credit, while the punishments that followed slander were swifter still than the slander itself. A man who had just brought an accusation would himself be accused, and would be led off together with the very man he had exposed, for the danger to one's own life cut short the king's inquiries. His bitterness reached such a pitch that he could not even look with kindness on anyone not yet accused, and he was harshest of all toward his friends. He barred many of them from the palace, and toward those on whom he had no power to lay hands, he was harsh in word. Antipater joined in against Alexander amid these misfortunes, gathering a whole company of kinsmen, and left no slander untried. The king was driven to such terror by Antipater's monstrous fabrications and contrivances that he seemed to himself to see Alexander standing over him, sword in hand. So he suddenly had him seized and bound, and turned to torturing his friends. Many died in silence, saying nothing beyond what their conscience allowed. Others, forced by their agonies to lie, said that Alexander was plotting against him together with his brother Aristobulus, that he was watching for his chance to kill him while hunting, and then meant to flee to Rome. Although these statements were not plausible but improvised under compulsion, the king believed them gladly, finding comfort in having bound his son, in the thought that he had not done so unjustly. But Alexander, once he saw that it was impossible to change his father's mind, resolved to meet the danger head-on, and composed four books against his enemies, in which he admitted the plot, but named as accomplices most of the men themselves, above all Pheroras and Salome, saying that Salome had even once forced herself upon him at night against his will. These books, loud with grave and terrible charges against the most powerful men, came into Herod's hands, and Archelaus hurried to Judea with all speed, in fear for his son-in-law and his daughter. He proved a most far-sighted ally to them, and skillfully turned aside the king's threat. Meeting Herod at once, he cried out, Where is that accursed son-in-law of mine? Where shall I see that head, a father's murderer, so that I may tear it apart with my own hands? And I will hand over my daughter too, to her fine bridegroom, for even if she has had no share in the plot, she is defiled simply by having become such a man's wife. I am amazed, too, at your patience, you who were the very man plotted against, that he still lives, Alexander, until now. I hurried here from Cappadocia expecting to find him already condemned, and meaning to discuss with you the question of my daughter, whom I had betrothed to him out of respect for your rank. But now we must take counsel about them both together, and if you are too indulgent a father to punish a treacherous son, let us join right hands and become heirs to each other's anger. With this bluster, he won Herod over, guarded as the king had been. He gave him the letters composed by Alexander to read, and going through them chapter by chapter, discussed each with him. Archelaus took this as his opening move, and little by little shifted the blame onto the men named in them and onto Pheroras. When he saw that the king believed him, he said, "We must consider whether the young man is really being plotted against by so many scoundrels, not by the young man himself. For I cannot see what reason he would have to fall into so great a crime, when he already enjoys the kingship and hopes for the succession besides, unless certain men were egging him on and exploiting the pliability of his age for evil ends. It is through such men that not only the young but even the old are deceived, and the most splendid households and whole kingdoms overturned." Herod agreed with what he said, and relaxed his anger against Alexander for a while, but grew the more incensed against Pheroras, for Pheroras was the subject of the four letters. Pheroras, seeing the king's volatility and Archelaus's friendship with him prevailing over everyone, realized there was no honorable way to safety, and so procured one through shamelessness. He abandoned Alexander and fled for refuge to Archelaus. Archelaus said he could not see how he could ask for his pardon when he was implicated in so many charges, from which it was plainly shown that he had plotted against the king and had caused the young man's present troubles, unless he was willing to drop his cunning and his denials and instead confess to the charges and beg forgiveness from his brother, who loved him. For in that case, Archelaus himself would cooperate in every way. Pheroras was persuaded, and having arranged himself so as to appear as pitiable as possible, in black clothing and in tears, he fell at Herod's feet, as he had often done before when begging pardon, confessing himself to be vile. For he had indeed done everything he was accused of, yet lamenting a derangement of mind and a madness, whose cause, he said, was his love for his wife. Having thus put forward Pheroras as his own accuser and witness, Archelaus at once began to plead for him and to check Herod's anger, using illustrations drawn from his own case. He too, he said, had suffered far worse at his brother's hands, yet had set the claims of nature above those of vengeance. For in kingdoms, as in large bodies, some part is always inflamed by its own weight, and this ought not to be cut off, but treated more gently. By saying much along these lines, he softened Herod toward Pheroras, though he himself continued to feign anger at Alexander, and declared he would separate his daughter from him and take her away, until he brought Herod round to pleading on the young man's behalf and to betrothing his daughter to him once again. Very convincingly, Archelaus said he would let her marry whomever she pleased, except Alexander, for he set the highest value on maintaining toward him the rights owed by the marriage bond. When the king said his son would receive this as a gift from him if he would not dissolve the marriage, since they already had children together, and the wife was so loved by the young man that her staying with him would restrain his faults, while her being torn away would drive him to total despair, for reckless daring grows milder when entangled with one's own affections. Archelaus reluctantly gave in, was reconciled, and reconciled the young man to his father. He said, however, that Alexander must by all means be sent to Rome to speak with Caesar, for he himself had written to him about the whole matter. So Archelaus's stratagem, by which he rescued his son-in-law, achieved its end, and after the reconciliation, they spent their days in feasting and mutual goodwill. As Archelaus was leaving, Herod presented him with gifts worth 70 talents, a gold throne set with jewels, eunuchs, and a concubine named Paniches, and he honored each of his friends according to his rank. In the same way, at the king's command, his relatives too all gave splendid gifts to Archelaus, and he was escorted by Herod and the nobles as far as Antioch. Not long after, a man far more capable than Archelaus at such stratagems arrived in Judea, one who not only undid the reconciliation Archelaus had arranged for Alexander, but became the cause of his destruction as well. He was a Spartan by birth, named Eurycles, driven into the kingdom by a longing for money, since Greece could no longer support his extravagance. He brought Herod splendid gifts as bait for what he was hunting, and having at once received many times as much in return, he considered a clean gift worthless unless he could trade in the kingdom through bloodshed. He went about winning the king over with flattery and cleverness of speech and false praises of himself. Quickly grasping Herod's character, and saying and doing everything to please him, he became one of his foremost friends. For the king, on account of his homeland, and everyone around him too, gladly gave the Spartan preference. Once he had learned the rotten spots in the household, the quarrels among the brothers, and how the father stood toward each of them. Finding that Antipater had already won him over through hospitality, he feigned friendship with Alexander, falsely claiming to have long been a companion of Archelaus as well. And so he was quickly received as one already trusted, and Alexander at once introduced him to his brother Aristobulus too. Having tested every face, he approached each in his own way. But above all, he became Antipater's hired agent and Alexander's betrayer, reproaching Antipater if he, being the eldest, would overlook those lying in wait for his hopes, and reproaching Alexander if he, born of a queen and married to a queen, would allow the son of a commoner to succeed to the throne, especially since he had so great an advantage in Archelaus. He posed as a trusted counselor to the young man, having fabricated a friendship with Archelaus. And so, holding nothing back, Alexander poured out to him his complaints about Antipater, and how, since Herod had killed their mother, it was no wonder if he also took from them her kingdom. At which Eurycles pretended to pity and share his pain. He induced Aristobulus to say the same things, and having entangled both of them in their complaints against their father, he went off and carried their secrets to Antipater. He also falsely added a plot, as though the brothers were lying in ambush for him, and all but drawing their swords already. Having taken a great sum of money on top of this, he became a champion of Antipater's cause even before the father. And finally, having contracted for the death of Aristobulus and Alexander, he became their accuser before their father, and coming to him declared that he was offering Herod his life in return for his benefactions, and repaying the light of day in exchange for his hospitality. For long ago a sword had been sharpened against him, he said, and Alexander's right hand made ready for it, and he himself had stood in the way, feigning cooperation in order to slow things down. For Alexander had said, he claimed, that Herod was not content to reign himself over what belonged to others, and, after murdering their mother, to have squandered her kingdom, but was even bringing in a bastard as successor, offering their grandfather's kingdom to Antipater the corrupter. He would avenge Hyrcanus and Mariam with his own hand, for it was not fitting, he said, that he should inherit the throne from such a father without bloodshed. There were, moreover, many things that provoked him daily, so that not even the most innocent kind of talk had been left free of slander. Whenever the noble birth of others was mentioned, he himself was insulted for no reason, since his father would say that Alexander alone was noble and despised his own father for his lack of noble birth. And in the hunts, if he made some mistake, he was met with silence, but if he did well, he was met with ironic praise. Everywhere he found his father implacable, and affectionate only toward Antipater, for whose sake he would gladly die too, if he failed in his plot. And if he succeeded in killing him, his best hope of safety, he said, lay first with Archelaus, being his father-in-law, to whom he could easily escape, and then with Caesar, who up to now did not know Herod's true character. For he would no longer, as before, present himself trembling before his overbearing father, nor speak only of his own grievances, but would first proclaim the nation's sufferings and the people taxed to the point of exhaustion, and then the luxuries and doings on which the money raised through bloodshed had been squandered, the sort of men from among them who had grown rich, and at whose expense the favored cities had been beautified. He would also seek out his grandfather there, and his mother, and would proclaim all the pollutions of the kingdom, crimes for which he would not be judged a parricide. Having fabricated such monstrous tales against Alexander, Eurycles heaped much praise on Antipater, declaring that he alone was devoted to his father, and for that reason had so far stood in the way of the plot. The king, not yet fully calmed after the earlier accusations, now flared up into an ungovernable rage. And once again, seizing the opportunity, Antipater sent forward other accusers against his brothers, to say that they were secretly conferring with Jucundus and Tyrannus, men who had once been the king's cavalry commanders, but had since fallen from their rank because of some offenses. Herod, in a fury over this, immediately had the men tortured. They, however, confessed nothing of what was charged against them. But a letter was produced and brought before the commander of the garrison at Alexandrian, from Alexander, urging him to receive him and his brother Aristobulus into the fortress once they had killed their father, and to let them make use of the weapons and the other resources there. Alexander said this was a forgery of Diophantus. Diophantus was the king's secretary, a bold man skilled at imitating anyone's handwriting, who, after many such forgeries, was in the end put to death for it. Herod tortured the garrison commander as well, but learned nothing from him either about the charges. Yet, although he found the proofs weak, he ordered his sons kept under guard, though still unbound for the moment, while he called Eurycles, the corrupter of his household and the stage manager of the whole abomination, his savior and benefactor, and rewarded him with 50 talents. Eurycles, outrunning the accurate report of events, went off to Cappadocia and extracted money from Archelaus too, daring to say that he had actually reconciled Herod with Alexander. Then, crossing to Greece, he put his ill-gotten gains to similarly base use. Indeed, having twice been accused before Caesar of filling Achaia with sedition and stripping its cities bare, he was sent into exile. Such was the requital that overtook him for the ruin of Alexander and Aristobulus. It is worth setting Euaristus of Cos over against the Spartan, for he too was among Alexander's closest friends, and, visiting at the same time as Eurycles, when the king questioned him about the things Eurycles had been slandering the young men with, he swore on oath that he had heard nothing of the kind from them. Yet this did nothing to help the unfortunate youths, for of all reports, Herod was quickest to lend an ear to those of wrongdoing, and anyone who shared his suspicions and shared his outrage found favor with him. Salome too provoked his savagery toward his children, for Aristobulus, wishing to bind her to their danger since she was both mother-in-law and aunt to them, sent word urging her to save herself, since the king was ready to kill her too, accused, as before, of secretly passing on the king's confidential business to Silius the Arab, whom she was eager to marry, though he was Herod's enemy. This news, like a final storm, overwhelmed the young men, already caught in the tempest, for Salome ran to the king and reported the warning she had received. Herod, no longer able to restrain himself, had both his sons bound and kept apart from one another, and sent Volumnius, the camp commander, and his friend Olympus in haste to Caesar, bearing written reports. When they had sailed to Rome and delivered the king's letter, Caesar was deeply distressed over the young men, but did not think it right to take from their father his authority over his sons. He wrote back then, establishing Herod as sole judge, but saying he would do well to examine the plot in a joint council of his own relatives and the governors of the province, and if they were found guilty, to put them to death, but if they had merely planned flight, to punish them more moderately. Herod complied with these instructions, and on arriving at Berytus, where Caesar had directed, convened the tribunal. The governors took their seats as Caesar's letter had prescribed, Saturninus and his colleagues from Pedanius's staff, together with Volumnius the procurator. After them the king's relatives and friends, Salome and Pheroras, and after them the leading men of all Syria, except Archelaus the king. For Herod, since Archelaus was Alexander's father-in-law, held him under suspicion. As for the sons themselves, he did not bring them before the court, very deliberately, for he knew that the mere sight of them would inevitably win them pity, and that if they were also given a chance to speak, Alexander would easily clear himself of the charges. So they were kept under guard in the village of Platana in Sidonian territory. The king, standing as though they were present, pressed his case, accusing them of the plot rather weakly, as one at a loss for proofs of it, but bringing forward countless insults, jeers, abuse, and offenses against himself, which he declared to the assembled council to be worse than death. Then, when no one contradicted him, he made a show of pity, as though he himself were the one convicted, and were winning a bitter victory over his own children, and asked each man's opinion in turn. Saturninus was the first to declare his verdict, that the young men should be condemned, but not to death, for it was not right for him, he said, with 3 children of his own standing by, to vote for the destruction of another man's children. The 2 envoys with him agreed, and some others followed their lead. Volumnius, however, opened with the grimmer sentence, and after him all condemned the young men to death, some out of flattery, some out of hatred for Herod, but none out of real indignation. At that point, all Syria and Judea alike hung in suspense, waiting for how the drama would end. Yet no one supposed that Herod's cruelty would go so far as to kill his own children. But he had his sons dragged off to Tyre, and from there sailed across to Caesarea, pondering what manner of death to give the young men. There was an old soldier of the king's, named Tyro, whose own son was a close friend and companion of Alexander's, and who himself had grown fond of the young men in his own right. Out of the excess of his indignation, he lost all self-control, and at first went about crying out that justice had been trampled underfoot, that truth had perished, that nature itself had been thrown into confusion, that life was filled with lawlessness, and everything else that his passion, careless of his own life, dictated to him. In the end, he even dared to approach the king himself and said, "To me you seem the most cursed of men, you who. Against your dearest kin you let yourself be persuaded by the most wicked men, if indeed, having often condemned Pheroras and Salome to death, you now believe them against your own children, men who, cutting off your legitimate heirs, leave you with Antipater alone, choosing for themselves a king they can easily manage. Consider, too, that this same man may one day earn the soldier's hatred for the death of his brothers, for there is no one who does not pity the boys, and many of the officers show their anger openly." As he said this, he named the men who were angry. Herod immediately arrested them and Tyron himself and his son. At this, a court barber named Trypho, driven by some supernatural folly, rushed forward and informed on himself. "This Tyron," he said, "tried to persuade me too, whenever I attended you with the razor, to cut your throat, and promised me great rewards from Alexander." Hearing this, Herod put Tyron, his son, and the barber to torture. The father and the barber denied everything, and when the son said nothing further, Herod ordered Tyron tortured more severely. The son, pitying him, promised the king he would tell everything if his father's life were spared. When the king agreed, he said that his father, persuaded by Alexander, had wanted to kill him. Some thought this had been invented to end his father's torment, others believed it true. In an assembly, Herod accused the officers and Tyron before the people and set the crowd on them. There, at any rate, they were killed along with the barber, stoned and clubbed to death. He then sent his sons to Sebeste, not far from Caesarea, with orders to strangle them. When the order had quickly been carried out, he had the bodies brought up to the fortress of Alexandrium to be buried with Alexander, their maternal grandfather. Such, then, was the end of Alexander and Aristobulus. With Antipater now undisputed heir, unbearable hatred against him arose from the nation, for everyone knew that he had contrived all the accusations against his brothers, and there lurked in him no small fear as he watched the growing family of the men he had destroyed. For Alexander had two sons by Glaphyra, Tigranes and Alexander, and Aristobulus had, by Berenice, daughter of Salome, sons Herod, Agrippa, and Aristobulus, and daughters Herodias and Mariam. Glaphyra, with her dowry, Herod sent back to Cappadocia once he had killed Alexander. Berenice, Aristobulus's widow, he married to Antipater's uncle on his mother's side, for Antipater, working to win over Salome, who was estranged from him, arranged this marriage. He also courted Pheroras with gifts and every kind of service, and sent no small sums of money to Caesar's friends in Rome. Saturninus and his circle in Syria, too, were all glutted with his gifts. But the more he gave, the more he was hated, since it was plain he was not being generous out of magnanimity, but spending out of fear. And it turned out that those who received something became no more friendly, while those to whom he gave nothing became still harsher enemies. He made his distributions more lavish by the day, seeing the king, contrary to his own hopes, caring for the orphans and showing repentance for those he had killed by pitying their children. Once, gathering his relatives and friends and setting the children before him, Herod filled his eyes with tears and said, "A grim spirit has taken from these children their fathers, but this loss stirs in me, together with nature itself, pity for their orphan state. Though I proved the unluckiest of fathers, I mean to prove a more devoted grandfather, and after my death to leave them guardians drawn from those dearest to me. I betroth your daughter, Pheroras, to the elder of Alexander's two sons, so that you will be bound to him as his necessary guardian, and to your son, Antipater, I betroth Aristobulus's daughter, so you may become a father to the orphan girl. Her sister my own Herod shall take, since on his mother's side he is grandson of a high priest. Let this be my settlement, one that none of those who love me should undo, and I pray God to bless these marriages for the good of my kingdom and my descendants, and to let these children look on with calmer eyes than their fathers did." Having said this, he wept and joined the children's right hands together, then kissed each one affectionately and dismissed the council. Antipater at once turned pale and showed his distress to everyone, for he supposed that the honor paid the orphans by his father meant the overthrow of his own position, and that he would again be in danger for everything if Alexander's sons had Archelaus and Pheroras the Tetrarch as their allies. He weighed his own unpopularity against the nation's pity for the orphans, and how eager and lasting the Jews' memory was for the brothers who had perished because of him. He resolved, then, to break off the betrothals by every means. He was afraid to approach his harsh and quick-to-suspect father by cunning, so he ventured to come to him directly and beg him not to strip him of the honor he had been granted, nor let him keep the name of king while the power belonged to others. For he would never control affairs, he said, if Alexander's son gained Archelaus as grandfather and Pheroras as father-in-law. He pleaded, since the royal family was so large, that the marriages be rearranged, for the king had 9 wives and 7 children by them, Antipater himself by Doris, Herod by Mariam, the high priest's daughter, Antipas and Archelaus by Malthace the Samaritan and a daughter Olympias, whom his own nephew Joseph had married, by Cleopatra of Jerusalem, Herod and Philip by Pallas Phasael. He had other daughters too, Roxane and Salome, the one by Phaedra, the other by Elpis. 2 of his wives were childless, a niece and a great niece. Besides these, there were the 2 daughters of Alexander and Aristobulus by Mariam. With the family so crowded, Antipater begged that the marriages be changed. The king was bitterly angered when he perceived Antipater's disposition toward the orphans, and the thought struck him concerning the murdered brothers that these children too might one day become material for Antipater's slanders. So at that time he answered him harshly and drove him away, but afterward, won over again by his flattery, he relented and married him to Aristobulus's daughter and his son to Pheroras's daughter. One can gauge how much Antipater's flattery achieved in these matters from Salome's failure in similar circumstances. Though she was his sister, and though she begged repeatedly, through Livia the wife of Caesar, to be given in marriage to Silius the Arab, Herod swore he would treat her as his bitterest enemy if she did not give up her pursuit, and in the end married her, against her will, to a certain Alexas, one of his friends. And of her daughters, he married one to Alexas' son, the other to Antipater's uncle on his mother's side. Of Mariam's granddaughters, one married her aunt's son Antipater, the other her uncle's son Phasael. Having broken off the orphans' hopes, and having arranged the marriages to his own advantage, Antipater sailed on as if his hopes rested on secure ground. And, adding to his wickedness a new confidence, he became unbearable, for being unable to shed the hatred each man bore him, he sought his safety instead by making himself feared. Pheroras too helped him in this, now that he was, as it were, already a settled king. There also arose a faction among the women at court, which stirred up fresh disturbances. Pheroras's wife, joined by her mother and sister and by Antipater's mother too, behaved with great insolence throughout the palace, and even dared to insult 2 of the king's daughters, for which Herod above all had come to detest her. Yet, hated as they were by everyone else, they held their ground. Only Salome opposed their unity, and told the king that their alliance boded no good for his affairs. When they learned of her accusation, and of Herod's anger, they gave up their open meetings and displays of friendship, and instead pretended to quarrel with one another when the king was listening. Antipater joined in this pretense too, openly clashing with Pheroras. But in secret, they met and held nighttime revels, and the watchfulness this required only deepened their unity. Salome, however, knew everything that was going on and reported it all to Herod. He blazed into anger, especially against Pheroras's wife, since Salome accused her more than the rest. So he gathered a council of friends and relatives and brought many charges against the woman, including the insult to his own daughters, and that she had paid the Pharisees money to work against him and had bewitched his brother into hostility toward him with drugs. Finally, he turned his speech to Pheroras, telling him to choose 1 of 2 things, either to remain his brother or to keep his wife. When Pheroras said he would sooner give up his life than his wife, Herod, not knowing what to do, turned to Antipater and ordered him to have no dealings with Pheroras's wife, or with Pheroras himself, or with anyone belonging to her. Antipater did not openly disobey the order, but secretly spent his nights with them. And fearing the watchful Salome, he arranged, through his friends in Italy, to have himself sent to Rome. For they wrote that Antipater ought after so long a time to be sent to Caesar, and Herod, without delay, sent him off with a splendid retinue and a great sum of money, and had him carry the will in which Antipater was named king, and Antipater's successor was to be Herod, the son of Mariam, the high priest's daughter. Silius, the Arab, also sailed to Rome, having disregarded Caesar's orders, and meaning to contest with Antipater the case which Nicolaus had more speedily won. He also had no small quarrel with Aretas, his own king, for he had killed several of Aretas's friends, including Soemus, one of the most powerful men in Petra. He had bribed Fabatus, Caesar's steward, with large sums, and used him as an ally even against Herod. But Herod, giving more, drew Fabatus away from Silius, and through him collected what Caesar had ordered paid. Silius, paying nothing, went so far as to accuse Fabatus before Caesar, saying he was steward not of Caesar's interests but of Herod's. Fabatus, angered by this, he was still held in the highest honor by Herod, betrayed Silius's secrets, telling the king that Silius had bribed his bodyguard Corinthus, whom he should be on guard against. The king believed him, for Corinthus had indeed been raised in the kingdom, though by birth an Arab. He at once arrested not only Corinthus, but two other Arabs found with him, one a friend of Silius, the other a tribal chief. Under torture, they confessed that they had persuaded Corinthus, for a large sum of money, to kill Herod. These men, after examination, were sent on to Rome by Saturninus, governor of Syria. Herod did not let up pressing Pheroras to separate from his wife, nor did he stop devising some means of punishing the woman, having many reasons for his hatred, until at last, in extreme anger, he banished both her and his brother. Pheroras, content with the insult, withdrew to his own tetrarchy, swearing that the only end to his exile would be Herod's death, and that he would never return while his brother lived. Nor did he come back even when his brother fell ill, though urgently summoned, for Herod wished to leave him certain instructions, believing he was about to die. But Herod, against expectation, recovered, and soon after Pheroras fell ill himself, and Herod proved gentler than before. Indeed, he came to him and nursed him with sympathy. Yet this did not overcome the illness, for after a few days Pheroras died. Though Herod had loved him to the last, it was even rumored that he himself had had him poisoned. He had the body brought to Jerusalem, proclaimed the deepest mourning for the whole nation, and gave him a most splendid funeral. Such was the end that came to one of the murderers of Alexander and Aristobulus. The penalty now passed to the true author, Antipater, beginning with Pheroras's death. Some of Pheroras's freedmen came to the king in distress, saying that his brother had been destroyed by poison, that his wife had brought him something unusually prepared, and that as soon as he ate it he fell ill. That 2 days before, her mother and sister had brought in a woman skilled in drugs from Arabia, supposedly to prepare a love potion for Pheroras, but that instead she had given him something deadly, procured through Silius, to whom this woman was known. Struck by these many suspicions, the king put maidservants and some free women to torture. One of the women, in her agony, cried out, "May God, who rules earth and heaven, punish the one responsible for these evils among us, Antipater's mother." Seizing on this lead, the king pursued the truth further. The woman revealed the friendship between Antipater's mother and Pheroras and his wives, and their secret meetings, and that Pheroras and Antipater used to drink with these women on their way back from the king, letting no servant or maid, man or woman, be present through the whole night. One of the free women made this disclosure. Herod then had the slave women tortured separately, one by one, and all of them told the same story as before, and added that Antipater had arranged with Pheroras that Antipater would go to Rome and Pheroras withdraw to Perea. For they had often said to one another that once Alexander and Aristobulus were gone, Herod would turn next against them and their wives, since after Mariam and her children he would spare no one else, so that it was better to flee as far as possible from the beast. They said too that Antipater, often complaining to his mother, said that he himself was already gray, while his father grew younger every day, and that he might well die before he even began his true reign. And even if his father should die at some point, when indeed would that be? So he would be left with only the briefest enjoyment of the succession, since the Hydra's heads kept sprouting again, the sons of Aristobulus and Alexander. His father had also stripped him of any hope for his own children, since it was not one of Antipater's own sons, but Herod, Mariam's son, whom he had named successor after his death. And in this too his father must think himself thoroughly worn down, since he intended to leave the will as it stood he would see to it. Antipater said that none of that generation was left alive. Herod, though the most child-hating of all fathers who ever lived, hated his brother far more. He had given him 100 talents just to stop speaking with Pheroras. When Pheroras asked what harm he had done him, Antipater answered that he wished Herod would take everything from them and let them live, if only naked. But there was no escaping so murderous a beast, one with whom no one could even show open affection for another. "Even now we meet each other only in secret," he said, "but we shall meet openly once we find in ourselves the courage and the strength of men." This was what the women said under torture, and also that Pheroras had planned to flee with them to Petra. Herod believed everything they said, on account of the 100 talents, since only with Antipater had he discussed that matter. His anger fell first on Doris, Antipater's mother. He stripped her of every ornament he had given her, and there were many talents worth, and banished her a second time. Pheroras' wives, having been reconciled, he now treated kindly despite the torture. But he was shaken with fear, and every suspicion set him ablaze. He dragged many who were not guilty into torture, afraid he might overlook one of the guilty. In the midst of this, he turned to Antipater the Samaritan, who was the steward of Antipater's estate. Torturing him, he learned that Antipater had sent for a deadly poison from Egypt through one of his companions, Antiphilus. That Theudian, Antipater's uncle, had received it from him and handed it over to Pheroras, for Antipater had instructed him to kill Herod while he himself was in Rome, safely removed from suspicion, and that Pheroras had entrusted the poison to his wife. The king summoned her at once and ordered her to bring what she had received. She went out as if to fetch it, but threw herself from the roof, forestalling both the exposure and the abuse she expected from the king. By the providence of God, it seems, who was pursuing Antipater, she did not fall on her head but to one side, and so survived. When she was brought to him, the king revived her, for she had been stunned by the fall, and asked why she had thrown herself down, swearing that if she told the truth he would free her from all punishment, but if she held anything back, he would tear her body apart with torture and not even leave it a grave. To this, the woman, pausing a moment, said, "Why indeed should I still spare the secrets of Pheroras, now that he is dead, or protect the man who has destroyed us all, Antipater? Listen, O king, and let God be witness with you to my truth, God who cannot be deceived. When you sat weeping beside the dying Pheroras, he called me to him and said, 'How greatly, wife, I misjudged my brother's feelings toward me, hating the one who loved me so, and plotting to kill the one who, even now that I am dying, is not at ease about me. But I already pay the penalty for my impiety. You take the poison you keep against him, left with us by Antipater, and destroy it quickly before my eyes, so that I may not carry the avenging fiend with me even to Hades.' At his command I brought it, and before his eyes poured out most of it into the fire, but I kept back a little for myself, against the unknown and against my fear of you." So saying, she produced the box, which still held a small amount of the poison. The king then turned the torture on Antiphilus's mother and brother, and they too confessed that Antiphilus had brought the box from Egypt, and that he had received the poison from his brother, a physician practicing in Alexandria. And now, the avenging spirits of Alexander and Aristobulus went about searching out and exposing every hidden thing, dragging into the inquiry even those furthest removed from suspicion. So it was discovered that even Mariam, the high priest's daughter, had knowledge of the plot, for her brothers, under torture, testified to this against her. The king punished the son for his mother's daring as well. He struck Herod, her son, from the will, though he was Antipater's designated successor. On top of this, Bathyllus too was drawn into the inquiry, the final proof of all that had been plotted against Antipater. He was a freedman of his, and he had brought yet another poison, the venom of asps and the juices of other reptiles, so that if the first poison should fail, Pheroras and his wife might arm themselves with this against the king. As a mere byproduct of his boldness against his father, Antipater had also brought along the letters fabricated against his brothers. Archelaus and Philip, the king's sons, were being educated at Rome, already young men and full of spirit. Eager to remove these two, who kept reviving in his prospects, Antipater forged letters against them in the names of their friends at Rome, while others he persuaded to write, corrupting them with money, saying that they spoke much abuse against their father and openly lamented Alexander and Aristobulus, and grew indignant at being recalled, for their father had already sent for them, and this was what most troubled Antipater. Even before his journey, while he was still in Judea, he had been buying up such letters against them from Rome, and approaching his father as though above suspicion, he would defend his brothers, calling some of what was written false and other parts merely the errors of youth. At the same time, having given great sums of money to those who wrote against his brothers, he tried to confuse the inquiry, buying up costly garments, embroidered coverlets, silver and gold cups, and many other treasures, so that by the sheer scale of this spending, he might disguise the wages he had paid for those letters. He had in fact spent 200 talents, and of these the greatest pretext was his lawsuit against Silius. Now that all of this, even the smaller matters, had come to light amid the greater evil, when every torture cried out his father's murder, and every letter cried out a second fratricide still, no one arriving from Rome reported to him what had happened in Judea, although 7 months had passed between the exposure and his return. So great was the hatred everyone bore him. Perhaps, too, the avenging spirits of his murdered brothers stopped the mouths of those who meant to report it. In any case, he wrote from Rome announcing the good news of his own swift arrival, and that Caesar had released him with honor. The king, eager to get the plotter into his hands, and afraid he might somehow learn the truth beforehand and be on his guard, wrote back a false, friendly letter, urging him to hurry, and saying that he would deal with the complaints against his mother once Antipater had pressed on with speed, for Antipater was not unaware of his mother's banishment. Earlier, in fact, he had received the letter about Ferora's death while at Tarentum, and made a great show of mourning, which some praised as filial devotion. But it seems, rather, that his confusion arose from his plot having failed, and that he was not weeping for Ferora's, but for his own agent. By now some fear of what he had done was creeping over him, that the poison might somehow be discovered. Then, in Cilicia, he received the letter from his father mentioned above, and pressed on at once. But as he was putting in at Celandaris, a certain foreboding about his mother's misfortunes seized him, his soul already divining them on its own.